And coming up next, Bill Resnick introduces Sharon Grant, who reads from Nicole Hannah Jones' important essay from the 1619 Project, Our Democracy's Founding, Ideals Were False When They Were Written, Black Americans Fought to Make It True.
Hi, folks. Bill Resnick here with Sharon Grant. Last week, Monday, we introduced you to an essay by Nicole Hannah Jones titled, Our Democracy's Founding Ideals Were False When They Were Written, Black Americans Have Fought to Make Them True. The essay is one part of a New York Times project written by its black journalists, also other people of color, and even some white journalists. The project is called 1619. It traces the black experience in the territory that became the United States from the landing of the first 20-some slaves in Jamestown, Virginia in 1619, almost exactly 400 years ago. I did the introductions, and Sharon Grant did the dramatic reading of excerpts from the essay. Sharon Grant's an Afro-American woman from Brooklyn and Chicago, as most spent more time, though, in Portland. Worked as a health educator for Multnomah County for 20 years. She's also an accomplished singer and also contributed her voice as the omniscient narrator in several documentary films. The essay started with Nicole Hannah Jones' family, their experience of brutal slavery, then along with millions of black, mostly sharecroppers, led by a woman called Grandmama, they migrated to the North in the 1940s to Waterloo, Iowa, to settle in a black ghetto across the river from the white side, in a town where the only jobs available for black women were as white housekeepers, and for men, manual jobs when labor was needed. Her family lived very poor, but through all of that, her father, who could never get a steady living wage job but worked himself to the bone, carefully flew and carefully tended an American flag, which mystified the young Nicole Hannah Jones. Through the essay, we come to understand why her father was flying the flag. Sharon Grant, you have already read last week Nicole Hannah Jones' portrait of slavery and the U.S. Constitution, its Declaration of Independence, its many passages that commit the country to freedom and democracy, indeed inalienable rights for all men. Yet the Constitution contains, at least in six provisions, it had the effect of treating black slaves as property that could be bought, sold, and disposed of like farm animals. Sharon Grant, let's start.
So, Bill, we're now in the essay with Nicole Hannah Jones' discussion of Lincoln and the Civil War. On August 14, 1862, a mere 5 years after the nation's highest courts declared that no black person could be an American citizen, President Abraham Lincoln called a group of five esteemed free black men to the White House for a meeting. The Civil War had been raging for more than a year, and black abolitionists, who had been increasingly pressuring Lincoln to end slavery, must have felt a sense of great anticipation and pride. The war was not going well for Lincoln. Britain was contemplating whether to intervene on the Confederacy's behalf, and Lincoln, unable to draw enough new white volunteers for the war, was forced to reconsider his opposition to allowing black Americans to fight for their own liberation. The president was weighing a proclamation that threatened to emancipate all enslaved people in the states that had seceded from the Union if the states did not end the rebellion. The proclamation would also allow the formerly enslaved to join the Union Army and fight against their former masters. But Lincoln worried about what the consequences of this radical step would be. Like many white Americans, he opposed slavery as a cruel system at odds with American ideals, but he also opposed black equality. He believed that free black people were a troublesome presence, incompatible with a democracy intended only for white people. Quote, free them and make them politically and socially our equals, he had said 4 years earlier. My own feelings will not admit of this. And if mine would, we well know that those of the great mass of white people will not, end quote. That August day, as the men arrived at the White House, after exchanging a few niceties, Lincoln got right to it. He informed his guests that he had gotten Congress to appropriate funds to ship black people once freed to another country. Lincoln told them, you and we are different races. Your race suffer very greatly, many of them, by living among us. while ours suffer from your presence. In a word, we suffer on each side. You can imagine the heavy silence in that room as the weight of what the president said momentarily stole the breath of these five black men. It was 240 years to the month since the first of their ancestors had arrived on these shores before Lincoln's family, long before most of the white people insisting that this was not their country. The Union had not entered the war to end slavery, but to keep the South from splitting off, yet black men had signed up to fight. Enslaved people were fleeing their forced labor camps, which we like to call plantations, trying to join the effort, serving as spies, sabotaging Confederates, taking up arms for his cause as well as their own. And now Lincoln was blaming them for the war. Quote, "Although many men engaged on either side do not care for you one way or the other, without the institution of slavery and the colored race as a basis, the war could not have an existence," the president told them. "It is better for both of us, therefore, to be separated," end quote. As Lincoln closed the remarks, Edward Thomas, the delegation's chairman, informed the president, perhaps curtly, that they would consult on his proposition. "Take your full time," Lincoln said. "No hurry at all." Nearly 3 years after that White House meeting, General Robert E. Lee surrendered at Appomattox. By summer, the Civil War was over, and 4 million black Americans were suddenly free. Contrary to Lincoln's view, most were not inclined to leave, agreeing with the sentiment of a resolution against black colonization put forward at a convention of black leaders some decades before. Quote, "This is our home, and this is our country. Beneath its sod lie the bones of our fathers. Here we were born, and here we will die," end quote.
We have walked through the shadows of death. We had to walk all by ourselves. But we'll never turn back. Until we have all been free.
That was Mavis Staples. Her song, "We'll Never Turn Back." And this is KBOO Radio, 90.7 FM, Portland, Oregon, for the Old Mill Variety Hour with Sharon Grant, who is presenting excerpts from an essay by Nicole Hannah-Jones on black struggle and its immense contribution to shape this country. So, Sharon, here we were born, and here we will die. Black state in the United States, and with abolitionists, made sure that the Union Army stayed in the South to protect former slaves, who were, of course, a majority of the population. They got organized to vote. So, Sharon, they accomplished a great deal in the short period that they stayed in power. Tell us about it.
Yes. As Nicole Hannah-Jones pointed out, they wrote the most egalitarian state constitutions the South had ever seen. More equitable tax legislation, laws that prohibited discrimination in public transportation, accommodation, and housing. Their biggest achievement was the establishment of that most democratic of American institutions, the public school. The freed slaves were, as Nicole Hannah-Jones wrote, the newly freed black people who had been prohibited from learning to read and write during slavery and were desperate for an education. So black legislators successfully pushed for a universal state-funded system of schools, not just for their own children, but for white children too. Black legislators also helped pass the first compulsory education laws in the region. Just 5 years into Reconstruction, every Southern state had enshrined the right to a public education for all children in its constitution. In some states, like Louisiana and South Carolina, small numbers of black and white children briefly attended schools together. And the newly freed blacks also made crucial gains nationally. Led by black activists and a Republican Party pushed left by the blatant recalcitrance of white Southerners, the years directly after slavery saw the greatest expansion of human and civil rights this nation would ever see. In 1865, Congress passed the 13th Amendment, making the United States one of the last nations in the Americas to outlaw slavery. The following year, Black Americans pushed white legislators to pass the Civil Rights Act, the nation's first such law and one of the most expansive pieces of civil rights legislation Congress has ever passed. It codified Black American citizenship for the first time, prohibited housing discrimination and gave all Americans the right to buy and inherit property, make and enforce contracts, and seek redress from courts. In 1868, Congress ratified the 14th Amendment, ensuring citizenship to any person born in the United States. The 14th Amendment also, for the first time, constitutionally guaranteed equal protection under the law. Ever since, nearly all marginalized groups have used the 14th Amendment in their fights for equality, including the recent successful arguments before the Supreme Court on behalf of same-sex marriage. Finally, in 1870, Congress passed the 15th Amendment, guaranteeing the most critical aspect of democracy and citizenship, the right to vote, to all men, regardless of race, color, or previous condition of servitude. For this fleeting moment, known as Reconstruction, the majority in Congress seemed to embrace the idea that out of the ashes of the Civil War, we could create a multiracial democracy that Black Americans envisioned, even if our founding fathers did not. But it would not last. And Nicole Hannah-Jones explains why. Because anti-Black racism runs in the very DNA of this country, as does the belief, so well articulated by Lincoln, that Black people are the obstacle to national unity. The many gains of Reconstruction were met with fierce white resistance throughout the South, including unthinkable violence against the formerly enslaved, wide-scale voter suppression, electoral fraud, and even, in some extreme cases, the overthrow of democratically elected biracial governments. Faced with this unrest, the federal government decided that Black people were the cause of the problem, and that for unity's sake, it would leave the white South to its own devices. In 1877, President Rutherford B. Hayes, in order to secure a compromise with Southern Democrats that would grant him the presidency in a contested election, agreed to pull federal troops from the South. With the troops gone, white Southerners quickly went about eradicating the gains of Reconstruction. The systemic white suppression of Black life was so severe that this period between the 1880s and the 1920s and 30s became known as the Great Nadir, or the second slavery. Democracy would not return to the South for nearly a century. White Southerners of all economic classes, on the other hand, thanks in significant part to the progressive policies and laws Black people had championed, experienced substantial improvement in their lives, even as they forced Black people back into quasi-slavery. As Waters McIntosh, who had been enslaved in South Carolina, lamented, "It was the poor white man who was freed by the war, not the Negroes."
That is a couple of stanzas from Lift Every Voice that has been called the Black National Anthem. This is Bill Resnick and Sharon Grant. Sharon reading from Nicole Hannah-Jones' essay, "Our Democracy's Founding Ideals Were False When They Were Written. Black Americans Fought to Make Them True." So far in the essay, Nicole Hannah-Jones has described the brief period after the Civil War when Black struggles won democratic constitutions and gains like public funding for education for all in the South, as well as on the national level winning crucial civil rights amendments, that is amendments 13, 14, and 15 that have been used for making great gains for women, sexual minorities, other people of color, and the white working class. As to blacks, however, the rise of white power led to Jim Crow segregation and murder in the South. Somewhat less thoroughly, segregation and police violence and being the last hired and first fired in the North, Nicole Hannah-Jones discusses how the caste system was developed and maintained for near 100 years after white power crucified the black freedom gained for a few years after the Civil War. Sharon Grant, Nicole Hannah-Jones then describes the black South and parts of the North in the period after that brief flowering of democracy in the United States, the re-enslavement of blacks called Jim Crow.
Despite the guarantees of equality in the 14th Amendment, the Supreme Court's landmark Plessy v. Ferguson decision in 1896 declared that the racial segregation of black Americans was constitutional. With the blessing of the nation's highest court and no federal will to vindicate black rights, starting in the late 1800s, southern states passed a series of laws and codes meant to make slavery's racial caste system permanent by denying black people political power, social equality, and basic dignity. They passed literacy tests to keep black people from voting and created all-white primaries for elections. Black people were prohibited from serving on juries or testifying in court against a white person. Georgia made it illegal for black and white people to be buried next to one another in the same cemetery. Alabama barred black people from using public libraries that their own taxpayers were paying for. Black people were expected to jump off the sidewalk to let white people pass and call all white people by Miss or Mister, no matter how old they were. In the North, white politicians implemented policies that segregated black people into slum neighborhoods and into all-black schools, operated whites-only public pools, and held white and colored days at the country fair, and white businesses regularly denied black people service, placing whites-only signs in their windows. States like California joined southern states in barring black people from marrying white people, while local school boards in Illinois and New Jersey mandated segregated schools for black and white children. This caste system was maintained through wanton racial terrorism, and black veterans, especially those with the audacity to wear their uniform, had since the Civil War been the target of a particular violence. This intensified during the two world wars because white people understood that once black men had gone abroad and experienced life outside the suffocating racial oppression of America, they were unlikely to quietly return to their subjugation at home. As Senator James K. Vardaman of Mississippi said on the Senate floor during World War I, black servicemen returning to the South would, quote, inevitably lead to disaster. Giving black men military airs and sending him to defend the flag would bring him to the conclusion that his political rights must be respected, end quote. Many white Americans saw black men in the uniforms of America's armed services not as patriotic, but as exhibiting a dangerous pride. Hundreds of black veterans were beaten, maimed, shot, and lynched. During the height of racial terror in this country, black Americans were not merely killed, but castrated, burned alive, and dismembered, with their body parts displayed in storefronts. This violence was meant to terrify and control black people. Still, just as white Americans feared, World War II ignited what became black Americans' second sustained mass movement for black civil rights, the first being Reconstruction. As the centennial of slavery's end neared, black people were still seeking the rights they had fought for and won after the Civil War. The right to be treated equally by public institutions, which was guaranteed in 1866 with the Civil Rights Act. The right to be treated as full citizens before the law, which was guaranteed in 1868 by the 14th Amendment. And the right to vote, which was guaranteed in 1870 by the 15th Amendment. In response to black demands for these rights, white Americans strung them from trees, beat them, and dumped their bodies in muddy rivers, assassinated them in their front yards, firebombed them on buses, mauled them with dogs, peeled back their skin with fire hoses, and murdered their children with explosives set off inside a church. For the most part, Black Americans fought back alone, yet we never fought only for ourselves. The bloody freedom struggles of the civil rights movement laid the foundation for every other modern rights struggle. This nation's white founders set up a decidedly undemocratic constitution that excluded women, Native Americans, and Black people, and did not provide the vote or equality for most Americans. But the laws born out of Black resistance guarantee the franchise for all and ban discrimination based not just on race, but on gender, nationality, religion, and ability. No one cherishes freedom more than those who have not had it. And to this day, Black Americans, more than any other group, embrace the democratic ideals of a common good. We are the most likely to support programs like universal health care and a higher minimum wage, and to oppose programs that harm the most vulnerable. For instance, Black Americans suffer the most from violent crime, yet we are the most opposed to capital punishment. Our unemployment rate is nearly twice that of white Americans, yet we are still the most likely of all groups to say this nation should take in refugees. The truth is that as much democracy as this nation has today, it has been born on the backs of Black resistance. Our founding fathers may not have actually believed in the ideals they espoused, but Black people did. As one scholar, Joe R. Fagan, put it, quote, "Enslaved African Americans have been among the foremost freedom fighters this country has produced," end quote. For generations, we have believed in this country with a faith it did not deserve. Black people have seen the worst of America, yet somehow we still believe in its best.
To be sure, Sharon Grant, we're at the end of our presentation. I'm going to give you a brief break. Sharon Grant is our tireless reader of the essay by Nicole Hannah-Jones titled "Our Founding Ideals Were False When They Were Written. Black America Fought to Make Them True." Through the essay that covers the Black experience for 400 years, from 20 slaves setting foot in 1619 in Jamestown, Virginia, all the way to today, Nicole Hannah-Jones does two things in the essay. For one, she chronicles that Black struggle to force America to live up to its ideals, that all humans have inalienable rights to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. For another, that U.S. liberty and democracy are a work in progress, and if you want to live free and democratic, you have to fight for it. Sharon Grant will now conclude the essay with Nicole Hannah-Jones, who at the end returned to her family's experience, to her father, who worked hard but never got steady living wage work. Still, he proudly flew the American flag on their front lawn.
So Ms. Jones continues, "At 43, I'm part of the first generation of Black Americans in the history of the United States to be born into a society in which Black people had full rights of citizenship. Black people suffered under slavery for 250 years. We have been legally free for just 50. Yet in that briefest of spans, despite continuing to face rampant discrimination, and despite there never having been a genuine effort to redress the wrongs of slavery and the century of racial apartheid that followed, Black Americans have made astounding progress, not only for ourselves, but also for all Americans. What if America understood finally in this 400th year that we have never been the problem, but the solution? When I was a child, I must have been in fifth or sixth grade, a teacher gave our class an assignment intended to celebrate the diversity of the great American melting pot. She instructed each of us to write a short report on our ancestral land and then draw that nation's flag. As she turned to write the assignment on the board, the other Black girl in class looked locked eyes with me. Slavery had erased any connection we had to an African country, and even if we tried to claim the whole continent, there was no African flag. It was hard enough being one of two Black kids in the class, and this assignment would just be another reminder of the distance between the white kids and us. In the end, I walked over to the globe near my teacher's desk, picked a random African country, and claimed it as my own. I wish now that I could go back to the younger me and tell her that her people's ancestry started here, on these lands, and to boldly, proudly draw the stars and those stripes of the American flag. We were told once, by virtue of our bondage, that we could never be American, but it was by virtue of our bondage that we became the most American of all."
Sharon Grant, thank you.
land is your land.